All right, well, look, let me remind you what we're up to here, where we are in this particular block of the course. The class as a whole is called American Society, How It Really Works. The first part of the semester is being devoted to the American economy, how it really works. Now, to set up that discussion, we need concepts. We need a way of evaluating how a system as complicated as an economy, how it really works, how it works. We have to have concepts to understand the mechanics, how it operates. And to do that, we've spent two lectures so far, and today will be the third, exploring the theoretical ideas behind the analysis of the market. Our first lecture presented an idealized view of the market, how it's supposed to work if it abides by certain kinds of principles. Last lecture and today, we're adding complexity to that simple account by focusing on ways in which markets actually don't do what they're supposed to do. What I'm giving you are tools which you then can bring to bear on any particular problem. So, for example, we'll be studying transportation on the environment on Thursday, transportation next week. And so if you're approaching the problem of the environment in the United States and in our society, and we're asking the question, how does the economy really work with respect to the environment? Crucial question. You'll be able to ask, well, is there a problem of information failure around the environment? Is there a problem of negative externalities? That's what we talked about last time. Is there a problem of short time horizons? Are the time horizons in which people make their choices compatible with the time horizons that need to be taken into account for a healthy environment? Right? So these are tools. These are tools that you can then use in your diagnosis of how particular parts of American society work. Some of the ideas are especially relevant for the economy that we've been talking about this week and last. But some of the concepts that I'm giving you in these lectures will be extremely relevant to every topic that we look at. And that's true for the issue of negative externalities, information, short time horizons, and it's true for the issue that we're engaging today, which we started last time and will continue today, the problem of public goods. The extent to which a society provides an ample array of well-developed public goods that provide benefits for everyone in the society in which they live, or whether the society and its mechanisms of producing things for people provides an undersupply of public goods, of things that people need to live a flourishing life, but which are not well provided by markets. Public goods, the underprovision of public goods. And we ended last time with basically providing a definition of public goods and then making this claim that profit-maximizing firms in competitive markets will fail to produce adequate public goods, even those public goods which are necessary for maintaining healthy markets. That's kind of an ironic thing, that you have certain things that are needed for healthy markets, for a good, vibrant market economy, like, for example, a very well-trained labor market, a workforce. High levels of training is really good for a market economy. It provides adequate supply of the skills needed for various kinds of economic activities, of employers in a market. The question then is, will markets actually do a good job in providing the necessary human capital, to use the economist term, or skills in a more everyday language? Will a market, if left to its own devices, provide an adequate supply of training? That's the problem of public goods. Now, before we go any further, I'd like us to have just a very brief discussion of what are some other examples of public goods. And we could use a kind of expansive notion. You might call them quasi-public goods. Remember, education has this quasi-public good character because your education provides you private benefits. And reasonably, if you are getting private benefits for something, you ought to pay for it. People should pay for the things which they personally benefit from, if there are no spillover effects for other people. But education is also a public good, because it improves the quality of life in the society in general. Everybody benefits from having a well-educated population, not just those who happen to get the education. It's better to be a less educated person in a highly educated world than a less educated person in an uneducated world. You'll have better health care, for example. You'll have better legal services. You'll have better engineers so that your buildings won't fall down on you. So there's all sorts of reasons why it's to everyone's advantage to have a highly educated population. And that's the public goods aspect. That I'm calling a quasi-public good. All right, so I want to ask you to just think about as many examples of public goods, things that, if provided to the society, benefit everyone to a greater or lesser extent, in contrast to purely private goods that only benefit the people who purchase and consume them. Okay, so let's do this quickly. Turn to the person next to you or behind you, and if you're stuck off all by yourself in a little corner, scoot over so you can participate in a little dialogue. I'll give you a minute and a half to think of additional public goods. Okay, go. Okay, let's go for it. Examples of public goods from the floor. A lot of people were talking. You've got to have some examples that came out of all that talk. Yeah?
Internet services that can allow people to exchange various information.
What? I didn't hear the first word.
Internet.
Oh, internet. Yeah, so having the internet available is a infrastructure that allows for communication, and it provides all sorts of services, even for people who don't pay for it. And having access to the internet, rather than just having it privately available by buying it yourself, is considered a public good. That's why libraries offer internet services, right? Because having it available is an enhancement, makes all sorts of things easier. Other examples? Yeah?
Public transportation, interstate highways, or even the lightning on the paved road.
Right, so highways are a good example. Even if you don't use interstate highways yourself, you know, you just stay at home, you don't go on road trips. Having a good, safe interstate highway system that enables people to travel around the country easily makes the society work better for everybody, not just for those people who happen to use it. And your first example was?
Public transportation.
And public transportation. We'll be discussing public transportation a lot, intensively next Tuesday, but a really good public transportation helps people who can't stand public transportation and prefer to drive, because the roads will be less congested. You know, this is an interesting thing, which we'll see next week, that the better your public transportation is, the easier it is to use private transportation. It's a kind of irony. It gets And that's why public transportation has a peculiar relation to privately provided transportation. Yeah.
The military and like public safety.
Yeah, public safety in the military, very good example. If you don't pay any taxes, so you don't in any way contribute to supporting national defense, of which the military is at the heart, you're protected by it as well. And the same for police and fire. There are places in the world where fire departments, all you have to subscribe to it. You have to actually pay an annual fee in order for a fire department to come to your house if your house is on fire. And there's been some places in the United States which are, because of budget constraints, are kind of getting towards that situation where fire departments won't come to houses that are outside of a particular jurisdiction. There have been, I mean, I don't remember the specific news incident. There was an incident last year where the fire department refused to go to a particular place because it was just outside of the jurisdiction, and there was no fire department that served that area, and the fire spread and affected people in the jurisdiction of the fire department. Well, obviously, it's better to have a fire department that's simply paid for as a public good and provides that service to everyone. Other examples? Yeah. Yeah, well, national parks and conservation are two quite different things because people consume national parks. You go to it, whereas conservation is a more general idea of preserving resources. Both of these, I think, are indeed public goods. National parks has more the character of something that benefits the people who use it. So somebody who hates nature and can't stand the outdoors and never goes to a national park, we have to ask, would their life be worse if we stop supporting national parks? Well, I think you can make a case that it is, because having the possibility of going is an enhancement of your freedom. If we didn't have national parks, then no matter how much you loved the outdoors, you couldn't take advantage of a well-protected national park system. So there's a sense in which expanding the available choices that people have and preserving that range of choices is a public good. But national parks do service the people who use them, and that's why there's a fee charged for them. To enter the national park, you have to pay something. And the fees that are charged at the national park are not sufficient to cover all the costs of national parks, but they go a little, you know, they're a significant part of the budget of national parks. Conservation, in a more general sense, is more like a pure public good, because that's really preserving resources for the future, which will benefit everyone in the future, rather than having resources squandered in the present. Here's a few other examples that haven't been mentioned. Scientific research. Scientific research is clearly a public good. Just imagine if all research was restricted to research that was commercially important, where investors could see that they would get a return on their investment in that research. And no other research was done. That would mean we'd have no research on basic knowledge, on basic science. And all of the commercially relevant, market-oriented research that's done is, in a sense, parasitic on basic science, right? It takes the results of basic science and uses them to advance in new technological frontiers, new pharmacological frontiers, new medical innovations, and so on. So scientific research, the production of knowledge, I think, is a very, very strong case for that being a public good. Everyone benefits from living in a world where a lot of scientific research is done, and done well. Free vaccinations. So vaccinations are a little different from a lot of other health care. So if you break a leg or get hit by a car while biking, and you get your leg fixed, mostly that's a benefit to me. Now, maybe it's also a benefit to all of you to have me able to lecture. You can decide whether that's a, as my children used to say, a true fact or not. But Certainly it's a benefit to me. Vaccinations are a bit different than just ordinary health care. Because living in a world where most people have vaccinations against contagious diseases prevents the spread of contagious diseases, even to people who aren't vaccinated. Having a high density of vaccinations is a crucial public health phenomenon, not just private health phenomenon. And that's why the opposition of various people to mandatory vaccinations for children is potentially so dangerous. If that movement really took off and a substantial number of kids no longer were vaccinated, we would predictably have disease outbreaks of the diseases which would otherwise have not occurred. And in some cases, those diseases have dire consequences. Vaccinations is therefore a public health, a public good. The expression public health, the word public before health in that expression, captures the public good aspect. Vaccinations are essentially like having a clean water supply without lead in it, right? So the scandal in Flint, Michigan last year, in which in order to save money, water department, the city government under peculiar conditions shifted its way of providing water to houses, and given the character of the pipes in the old water system, created a lead crisis, which severely damaged the health of children in Flint, Michigan. Well, that clearly, clean water coming out of your tap is a public good. And the trust that we have in the municipality to ensure that the quality of that public good is provided was broken in Flint, Michigan. Well, those are public goods. Well, how do we understand the problem of providing public goods in a market? Now, here I have to introduce another one of our big ideas. So you can make another double asterisk in your notes. You will, with 100% guarantee, be asked the question about this idea in its various ramifications, which we will be exploring throughout the semester. The idea of free riding in the provision of public goods. But just think of it as the free rider problem. Free rider problem. Now, I'm going to introduce this idea in a peculiar way, by telling you a story. This is not a story that I made up. This is the classic way that this idea is introduced. It's called the story of the prisoner's dilemma. Any of you who have ever taken a course in game theory or probably most economics courses introduce this idea of the prisoner's dilemma. It turns out, however silly this story seems, to be a really profound insight into the human condition and to the difficulty in getting us to cooperate to produce public goods. So, let me tell you the story of the prisoner's dilemma. Here's how you set it up. Here's the story. There's two prisoners. We'll call them prisoner X and prisoner Y. Why not? Not very interesting names, but X and Y. They both get caught after a robbery. They're held in separate interrogation rooms. And they're each told the following. If you confess to the crime and implicate your partner, then you will get a certain number of years in prison. If you remain silent, you'll get a certain number of years in prison, okay? So they're asking the prisoners, each of them separately, did you do it, implicate your partner, or are you gonna remain silent? Are you gonna rat on your accomplice or remain silent? Now this matrix that's on the slide tells you what your punishment is depending upon not just what you do, but what you and your partner do. That's the key idea here. Your fate depends both on your choice and on the choice of the partner. And you have no control over that person's choice. You can only make your own decision. So here's the options. If you are silent, you are not going to rat. You're going to cooperate with your partner. You're going to do the cooperative thing from the point of view of bank robbers. That is, you don't rat on your partner. If you are silent and your partner is silent, you both get 2 years in prison. If you confess and your partner is silent, if X confesses and Y is silent, you get off free and your partner gets 10 years in prison. If you remain silent and your partner confesses, you get 10 years in prison. And he gets off or she gets off scot-free. And if you both confess, you both get 5 years in prison. All right, that's a simple set of choices. What do you do? Well, let's suppose you're the kind of person that really is only concerned about your own welfare. You don't really give a damn about your partner. You collaborated, you were partners in crime, but now that you're caught, all that you care about is minimizing your own punishment. That's what you care about. So which of these options is your preference? If you're prisoner X, your preference, your highest preference is to get no years in prison, right? That's the best thing that could happen, to get off without any years in prison. Zero is better than two. Your second preference is to get only 2 years in prison. Your third preference is to get 5 years in prison, and your worst option is to get 10. 0, 2, 5, 10. Right? So if you're only thinking about yourself, you're saying to yourself, what's good for me? 0 is better than 2, 2 is better than 5, and 5 is better than 10. Completely unambiguous rank ordering. There's absolutely no ambiguity as to which of those is better and how you would rank them. So what does that mean you do? And the other person also, of course, has the same character traits, and they also prefer 0 to 2, 2 to 5, and 5 to 10. So what choices do you make? So what do? You say, okay, let me suppose that my partner is silent, hypothetically. What should I do if my partner is silent? I should confess, right? Because if my partner is silent and I confess, I get 0 years in prison. What should I do if my partner confesses? I should confess, because 5 years is better than 10. Aha, I should confess regardless of what I think my partner is going to do. Even if I'm sure my partner is this idiot and he's going to remain silent, haha, I'm going to confess because then I get 0 years in prison. If my partner is silent, I confess. If my partner confesses, I confess. If I'm only looking out for what's best for me. And what that means is that my choice turns out to be independent of what my partner does. My best option is always to confess. Unfortunately, my partner is thinking the same way because he's facing exactly the same matrix of choices. Matrix just means the set of options that you had in front of you. So my partner confesses and I confess and we both get 5 years in prison. Now here is the irony and why this is called the prisoner's dilemma. We end up with 5 years in prison even though both of us prefer 2 years to 5 years. That is, we unequivocally would say, yes, I would rather have only 2 years in prison rather than five. But acting rationally, we're not crazy, we're not making a mistake. We're acting rationally in our own self-interest. That's what markets tell you to do, right? Adam Smith's quote about the invisible hand was, each person seeking only their gain, personal gain, through an invisible hand that generates the best solution for the society. In this case, it would be for the two prisoners. Well, here's a case where each person seeking their own personal gain results in an outcome which is clearly not the best for the two of them. They get 5 years in prison instead of two. They get 5 years instead of two. They get an outcome which is harmful to themselves because they relentlessly pursue their own self-interest. Now, that is one of these insights into the human condition, which I think has profound ramifications for how we think about all sorts of things. We'll see that this plays a huge role in how we should think about politics and elections. I won't give you that story now, but it'll play a role in our discussion of politics and power. But it plays a really critical role inside of the operation of markets. Now, let me give you the classic example where this has an economic has economic implications. This is exactly an application of the prisoner's dilemma. Everybody self-interested, seeking their own maximum benefit, in which they produce an outcome in which everybody, including themselves, get a suboptimal, a less than desirable outcome. This is called the tragedy of the commons. And it is a direct application of the mechanisms in play in the prisoner's dilemma. And it's the tragedy of the commons which illustrates the problem of the provision of public goods, which is the point of our discussing this situation here. All right, so what is this tragedy of the commons? The commons in European history was a term used to describe the common grazing lands available to small farmers and peasants in the medieval and early modern period. So the basic idea was this. Everybody had their own small plots of land for growing food and whatever, but they also had an area of grassland typically, at least in the stylized story, it's a meadow, in which they could graze their sheep. So the grassland was not owned by any particular person. It was owned in common by the community. The commons was owned in common by the community. So here is a stylized example. If everyone grazes one sheep on the commons, if everybody in this community grazes one sheep, the fertility of the commons will remain intact year after year, and every year you'll have a healthy sheep with healthy wool and healthy mutton. If everybody grazes one sheep, it will be healthy. If everybody grazes two sheep, the commons will be overgrazed and the quality of the grasslands will decline, and the results of grazing will be less for everybody. All right, so here's your payoff matrix. It looks just like the prisoner's dilemma. If you graze one sheep and everyone else does the same, so now I'm framing the issue of you as an individual farmer and everybody else in your community. Those are the two actors, you and everybody else. And you only control what you do. You don't control what anybody else does. Everybody makes their own separate choice, right? So this category, everyone else, consists of all the other people who are just like you, making the same kind of choice. All right, if you and everybody else grazes one sheep, everybody earns the equivalent of $10 a year in sheep products. If you graze two sheep, if you sneak an extra sheep onto the commons and everybody else continues to graze one, everyone else still earns 10 because one sheep, after all, isn't going to make much of a difference, and you get 20. So if you defect from the cooperation, but everybody else continues to cooperate, aha, you double what you earn. If everybody grazes two sheep, everybody earns $8 a year over time because of the deterioration of the quality of the meadow. If you stubbornly just graze one sheep and everybody else grazes two, the quality of the metal will decline, and you're just going to earn $4 a year, and everybody else earns $8. Because you're only grazing one, half as many sheep as everybody else, they get 2 times 4, and you just get $4 a year. So if you're a self-interested person who doesn't care about the values of solidarity, of cooperation, you're not concerned about the well-being of anybody else besides yourself. You're just asking, what's good for me to do? Your first choice would be, graze 2 would be B. I'd like to get 20, that's better than just getting 10. Your second choice is 10, I'd rather get 10 than get 8. Your third choice is 8, and your fourth choice is 4. B, A, D, C. That is the rank ordering of your preferences. You would really love it if everybody else grazed just one sheep and you could get away with grazing 2. That's great, you earn twice as much as everybody else. Well, if you don't, if that isn't possible, then at least what your next preference would be for everybody to graze 1 a year. What you really don't want to have happen is for you to graze 1 a year and everybody else graze 2. That's something which we'll refer to later as the sucker penalty, right? You're a sucker. If everybody else is cheating on the commons and you're maintaining your moral position of saying, I'm going to do the right thing, only graze 1, but everybody else grazes 2, well, that's called the sucker penalty. How much worse are you for doing the right thing when everybody else does the wrong thing? The difference between 20 and 10, if you graze 2 and everybody else grazes 1, compared to everybody grazing 1, that $10 difference, 20 versus 10, that's called the free rider bonus. And you see where the word free rider comes from. You are getting a free ride on everyone else's good behavior. You're getting a free ride on everyone else's willingness to cooperate properly. So the $10 bonus is the free rider benefit, or the free rider bonus. The $4 deficit, you're earning 4 and everybody else is earning 8, is the sucker penalty. And as everybody else is being a schmuck and violating the rules, but you're steadfastly doing the right thing, well, you get punished for that. You earn half as much as everybody else because you're following the rules. Well, this is called the tragedy of the commons. It's a tragedy because everybody really wants to just do the best for themselves. Everybody would rather earn 10 than 8. And yet, because each person separately chooses to maximize their own profits, their own advantage, because everybody individually decides to do that, everyone ends up in D. D is the outcome. That's the equilibrium. That's what it's called. It's the kind of stable position that you end up with when everybody makes their separate choices individually. Another example. Free riding and public goods provision. Actually, let me give, before I give you this, this is a complicated example which we'll be discussing at length in a few lectures. The tragedy of the commons is not just a theoretical idea. It did result in overgrazing in many commons areas in England. But more recently, the depletion of fish stocks in the North Atlantic is a perfect example of a free rider problem, of a destruction of the commons. A healthy fish stocks in the cod banks of the North Atlantic is in the interests of all fishermen. If every fisherman, however, on any given year catches as many fish as possible, which is to their advantage, they're better off catching as many fish as possible rather than fewer fish, the fish stocks collapse. And that's exactly what we've seen when you have unregulated access to what's called the common pool resource of fish stocks. The training and education issue is more complicated. Let me briefly mention it now, because this is an example which we will be discussing a lot in the last lecture of this series on how the market works. And it once again shows why, if you leave certain crucial components of what markets need to the actors in the market themselves, you will get an under-provision of a public good. So here the issue is this. You're an employer, and you have a choice. Am I going to provide training to my employees to improve their productivity? Or am I not going to provide training to my employees in order to increase productivity? Well, let's suppose that training costs $10,000 a year. Costs something, $10,000 a year. And the extra gross profits you get from trained workers is $30,000 a year. So if you provide training, costs you $10,000, and your profits go up by $30,000, you will have a net gain of $20,000. So if you provide training, you'll end up with $20,000 more. But let us suppose that all the other firms in your labor market are providing this training, and you decide not to. What happens? Well, you can hire the workers from other firms for a bit more than they're being paid in that other firm. You can poach them and gain the benefits of the added training they've received without having spent the costs on the training. Well, that's a clever thing to do if you're a profit-maximizing capitalist. Let other firms provide the training, and then you poach their workers. You poach their workers. Then you get $30,000 benefit, not just $20,000, right? You didn't have to pay for the training. You still get the productivity increase. Your profits have gone up by $30,000. Of course, if every firm thinks in the same way, nobody provides the training, and you end up with no gain, zero gain in your profits. And if you provide the training in spite of that because you think it's the good thing to do and all your trained workers get poached by other firms, your profits go down by $10,000. You've spent the money on the training, but you've got none of the benefits from it. Now, this is a real problem in labor markets and in the provision of training. And one of the reasons it's a problem is because a lot of training is best done at the workplace rather than in schools. It's the hands-on training that takes place in a workplace that really accelerates the capacity of workers to learn how to learn for the tasks and technological changes that they will face in that particular line of work. One of the ways that firms that feel they have to provide training do then is they put in or try to put in non-compete clauses in the contracts with workers in which they try to block other firms poaching their workers by making it illegal for a worker who works for that firm to work for a firm in the same sector for a year, let's say, after they leave the firm where they received the training. But note, that's a pretty severe abridgment of freedom. In order to solve the problem of the training costs, what an employer does is abridge the freedom of employees by saying you can't sign a contract to work for another firm in this sector. In some parts of the country, non-compete clauses like that are illegal for precisely that reason. It's an impediment to the freedom of choice, the freedom of movement, the freedom of contract of workers. In other places, like in Wisconsin, non-compete clauses are quite legal. Epic, a big employer in Madison that employs some 10 or 12,000 people, mostly in their 20s, you know, vast army of young techie types working at Epic, a medical systems software company, has a very strong non-compete clause. And when workers then in that firm get dissatisfied because of the very demanding long hours and other aspects of the employment practices, which I know from people I've talked to who have worked there, some people find just really oppressive, They feel stuck because the skills they have and the skills they brought to EPIC in the first place mean that they're most employable in the sector in which EPIC is located. That's one of the reasons they went to EPIC to work in the first place. But they can't get a job for a year if they quit in the sector for which they're trained. That's a pretty heavy restriction on their autonomy. But it's a solution, it's a coercive solution to the free rider problem in training. Well, we'll discuss that in a few weeks. So, free rider problem. That is an intrinsic problem in all sorts of market situations in which individuals are pursuing their self-interest in a context where the payoff of pursuing your self-interest depends upon what other people do, not just what you do. That's the key idea here. The payoff for the pursuit of your interest depends not just upon how successfully you pursue your interests, but it also depends upon what other people choose to do. And that interdependence of your choices and strategies, that's what's represented in these matrices. This is called, by the way, a payoff matrix. A payoff matrix tells you what the outcome is going to be dependent upon what your choice is and what other people's choices are. And then you see the payoff matrix and then you rank order the options. Here's a contrast that's important. And it's really important to have this very clearly in mind. We've talked about two kinds of problems in a market, negative externalities and the free rider problem. Two kinds of problems, both of which create negative effects, right? Negative externalities is one type of problem, free rider problem is another. Here is the contrast. With a negative externality, I benefit by imposing costs on you. But I benefit. I'm not hurting myself. When an industrial firm puts toxic wastes into a river, and it goes downstream and forces downstream communities to clean up the water before they can drink it, that firm that dumps the water, dumps the toxic waste into the water, increases its profits. It's lowered its costs and therefore increased its profits. It benefits by displacing costs onto others. That's a negative externality. A free rider problem is really quite different. The free rider problem in providing public goods. Everyone is harmed, including me, because of free riding. But I am even worse off if I individually refuse to free ride. This is a Pareto suboptimal solution. Remember Wilfredo Pareto, the Italian economist whose name is emblazoned in this idea of Pareto optimality? In Pareto optimality, nobody can be made better off without somebody being made worse off. Well, a free rider situation is not like that. A free rider situation is suboptimal in terms of that principle, because everybody can be made better off without anyone being made worse off simply by cooperating with each other, rather than by pursuing relentlessly your own self-interest. So here's the contrast. And I'm saying it again because my experience is that this is a slippery idea, and it tends to take repetition to get emblazoned. This is one of the ideas which I hope 10 years from now, over a barbecue, you remember in some argument you'll have with somebody who's saying nonsense about something or other, right? Negative externality. I have the power to impose costs on you, on other people. That's a negative externality. Free rider problem. In the relentless pursuit of self-interests, we end up with a suboptimal solution that harms me as well as everyone else. That's the free rider problem. We will encounter this many times. Well, There are solutions to the free rider problem. I mean, I've talked about the free rider problem as something that happens when everyone relentlessly pursues their self-interest and makes their individual choices. We overfish the fishing stock. The prisoners both get higher sentences. We underprovide training. This is the free rider problem. But, of course, we observe in the world lots of cooperation. Lots of cooperation. It's not the case that the free rider problem actually prevents cooperation from occurring. So there are solutions to the free rider problem. There are solutions. Okay, another little break in the action. But actually, let's see without the little mini discussion. Let's see what you have to say. If I don't get some interesting interventions, then I'll say, okay, let's turn to mini discussions for a minute or two. How do we get out of this box? How do you get out of the free rider problem since we actually observe people cooperating? What happens? How do we do it? What's the solution? Raise your hand so I can see who's, yeah. So regulation. So that means there's a third party that we haven't mentioned so far, right? You have all the fishermen fishing. They can't solve the free rider problem. So what do? They set up a government that imposes fishing restrictions and says, no, you can only catch 10,000 fish a year if you're a trawler or whatever the rules are. And we will have some kind of monitoring system to see that you don't cheat. And if you do cheat, you'll be punished sufficiently to have made it not worthwhile to cheat. Right? So you have to set up a state with coercive capacity to enforce the rules of the common. That is one solution. That is one solution. Other solutions. Yeah. Right, so you could have a monopoly, you could have a one firm that basically acts kind of like a state. It is imposing the coercive solution. One would generally think that a big, powerful corporation that imposes the coercive solution on all the smaller fishermen is less likely to do so in an even-handed way than a government regulator that was democratically accountable to some broader community. But it could happen that you'd have a benign monopolist. I mean, it's possible that you have some far-sighted, generous monopolist who actually might do a better job. Who knows? Yeah?
Allow firms to trade.
Well, there are complicated schemes that sometimes sort of work in which you give fishermen licenses to catch a certain number of fish, and then you allow them to trade those licenses. But note, allocating those licenses requires a state to enforce the licenses. So that turns out to be just another form of regulation. It's just another way of doing the regulation. There's a feeling that, yes, it's a little rigid if the government just directly allocates a fishing quota to each fisherman, because some fishermen, some years, will have reasons why they especially need more fish. They need more income for some reason. Maybe that year they're going to refurbish all their boats, so they need more profits that year. Whereas other fishermen may be scaling back, they're closer to retirement, maybe they need a smaller quota. So if you allow fishermen to trade their quotas, well, that might create a more flexible system. But that really is not a market solution. That still requires a very strong state that will monitor compliance and impose the aggregate quota, and see that there isn't cheating in the course of those trades. Let's see if anybody else has. Yeah?
For oligopolies?
Well, oligopolies or cartels are another device which is basically the same as either doing what a state does, but more likely less fairly, or doing what a monopolist does, but probably a bit better than that. But it's still a cartel. You know, you get all the mafia bosses together to regulate, the fishing stocks. Well, they can do it, and they do it with coercion. But it tends to be, when it's done that way, more exploitative. Any other thoughts, new thoughts on these issues? Yeah.
Can you have the government purchase certain strategic areas for fishing and then sell it primarily
So have the government buy the fishing stocks and then sell off the rights to the fishing stocks, just as you're selling rights to the airwaves or rights to something else, so that you privatize the commons. You make it no longer a commons. You give individual fishermen companies exclusive rights to a certain part of the fishing stocks. That is a solution that is sometimes proposed. It tends to produce high concentrations of power. It does preserve the fishing stocks if it's done right, but it does not produce a competitive market in fish. What it does is it gives people exclusive rights over part of the fishing stocks. And it still requires very heavy monitoring to be sure there's not cheating. There's no way to do any of these things without a regulatory state that imposes the rules. Well, there's one whole class of solutions that we haven't mentioned. So the first solution, which is what we have been talking about, is the government provides the public goods. Instead of relying on the market, the government blocks free riders through regulations. And there's nuances in how you do the regulation, but that's essentially what we've been talking about. The government provides the public goods by taxation of one sort or another, or provides the costs of regulation through taxation. But there's another kind of solution, which is called conditional altruism, which says that the assumption of the free rider problem and the prisoner's dilemma, the underlying assumption may just not be right. That underlying assumption was that people are acting in purely self-interested ways for their own gain. They just don't care about anything else. Well, people are sometimes like that, but they're not always like that. People are not purely selfish, and they can actually prefer to cooperate with other people. They can feel that's the right thing to do. They don't want to be a scumbag. They don't want to be a free rider. Free riding is wrong. We've all been taught that. You know, do your share, pitch in. It's not right to be a freeloader on other people's effort, on other people's sacrifice, on other people's willingness to cooperate. You should be a free rider. Should not be a free rider. People feel moral obligations to cooperate, and they may also genuinely care about the well-being of other people, not just themselves. This means that it's not really like a prisoner's dilemma any longer. The payoff matrix is different than in the prisoner's dilemma. So in the prisoner's dilemma, everybody prefers B over A, and A over D, and D over C, right? So the prisoner's dilemma, rank ordering of those cells is B, A, D, C. This is the sheep on the commons story. But let's suppose that you really believe in the commons. You think it's the morally right thing to do, and you think of yourself as a moral person. You know you could cheat and get more, but you don't want to cheat because you're not a cheater. That's not the kind of person you are. So your highest preference is everybody cooperates. That's your first choice. Your worst choice is being a sucker. You want to do the right thing, but you don't want to be a sucker if everybody else is a free rider. Right? You don't want to contribute to the common good as a martyr. You want to do the right thing conditional upon other people doing the right thing. That's why it's called conditional altruism. You want to do the right thing. You believe in that principle. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Good principle. It's a principle that's pretty much inscribed in moral codes across cultures in one form or another. You want to do the right thing, but you don't want to be a sucker. So you, your highest preference is A, your worst preference is C, and you're confused about whether you prefer B or C. B or D. There's no clear rank ordering if you're a conditional altruist for those intermediate cases. Conditional altruism is a pervasive phenomenon. It's probably as important as the free riding problem, right? One way for those of you who study economics and others who may or are studying sociology, one way of thinking about sociology versus economics is sociologists kind of assume that moral principles and following norms is pervasive in society. So what I'm calling conditional altruism is a common phenomenon, and it solves all sorts of problems of cooperation. And we're kind of shocked when we see people acting like pure free riders, where they take advantage of every possibility of cheating on other people's sacrifice. So for sociologists, when norms aren't present of that sort, we're surprised and we seek an explanation. Why are people acting that way? Economists assume that everybody always acts that way. Everybody is always a free rider, and they're kind of shocked when people cooperate with each other. So economists are shocked when people act on moral principle, violating their self-interest in the narrow sense of economists. And sociologists, I'm overstating this, of course, but sociologists are kind of shocked when people act as pure economic, individual, self-interested maximizers. Conditional altruism is important. It's pervasive. And one of the questions we can ask about a society and about the way an economy actually works is, does it encourage free riding or does it encourage conditional altruism? Which of these principles gets reinforced in the daily lives of people? Are you encouraged to be in settings where you solve problems by figuring out how to cooperate? Or are you in situations where you solve problems by pursuing strictly your own self-interest? Well, that's the free rider problem and conditional altruism, and we will encounter that when we discuss the environment, when we discuss public transportation, when we discuss the training system, and in a different form when we discuss healthcare. Okay, the final issue around free markets is the connection between free markets and social values which don't themselves have anything particularly to do with markets. Here's the key idea. This is a kind of trivial statement. It's sort of sociology 101. It's a kind of basic claim of sociology. Institutions shape values. Institutions shape values. That's a grand claim. The point is to give it some content. Here then is the relevance of this claim for the matters at hand. Free markets, that is, markets that are not regulated by social norms and rendered democratically accountable by appropriate regulation. Under-regulated markets have significant effects on various kinds of values. Markets are an institution. Unregulated free markets are a particular form of the market institution. And the claim is that it has particular kinds of effects on other values. First, it erodes values around community. Second, it commercializes all sorts of morally salient aspects of life. And third, it cultivates skills of exit over skills of voice. So let me say something about each of these. First, it erodes community. An unregulated market encourages intense competition at all levels of society. Intense competition among firms, intense competition among students in universities, intense competition among people in labor markets. Intense competition means that people find themselves in situations where there are winners and losers, in which one person's gain is another person's loss. That's intense competition. Competing against each other, trying to beat out other people, trying to win over other people. Markets encourage the cultivation of skills of competition and the value of winning over others, rather than encourage the value of cooperation, mutual sacrifice for collective gain. Markets don't cultivate that kind of cooperative, those kinds of cooperative values rooted in what we might think of as community solidarity. Second, the commercialization of morally salient aspects of life. So there are lots of aspects of life which are not themselves part of markets, which have values that we hold very dear, but which get corrupted by the pervasiveness of markets. Here's an example. This, I think if you think about it, you'll see why this is an example. Most people probably don't think of it this way. Spirituality. The values that are at the very core of the religious experience of people in different faith communities. Now, we have in the United States highly commercialized forms of religion in which you have mega churches in which the pastors become fabulously rich from the selling of spiritual services as a commodity. You know this phenomenon. It's a quite distinctive feature of religion in America. Although it's because of our influence around the world, you find these kinds of mega churches with fabulously rich pastors now in various third world countries and developing countries as well. I was in Soweto, the black township in Johannesburg, as part of a research project, and visited a mega church in Johannesburg that's run by a pastor from Brazil who has mega churches all around the world and is, you know, probably at this point a billionaire, certainly a multi-millionaire, lives a fabulously rich life by selling religious services. That's in contrast to how most religious people understand the value of religion. Not as a commodity to sell and make a fortune, but as a value to be shared in a communal and mutually respectful way. Another example of the spillover effects of commercialization on other aspects of life. When 9/11 occurred and the Congress passed a compensation bill for people who have family members who died in the Twin Towers, the issue was, how much should people be compensated for? And the formula ended up that the higher your wages, the higher your salary, the richer you were, the more your family was compensated for your loss of life in the Twin Towers. Now, many people found that very troubling, that some lives were worth more public compensation. I mean, remember, this isn't because they had private life insurance policies. That's a separate matter. This is because we felt as a collective, as a democratic community, that there was a failure of the society to protect our borders to terrorism. And this was such a symbolically powerful event that we, in a spirit of compassion for the families, wanted to compensate families for the loss of lives of loved ones. But then when it turned out that some people would be compensated in millions and others just in thousands of dollars, that troubled people. The response was, well, that's the market, you know. Some people's lives are worth more on the market because they could have earned more. That just seemed a corrosive way of thinking about what's in play in the loss of life. It's the same kind of reasoning that the Ford Pinto Company had. Remember the story of the exploding gas tanks? They simply asked, well, there's a certain market for death. We will be fined this amount by courts. It's just not worth us making the $11 gas tank improvement. Well, they just made a simple commercial calculation about the value of life. Now, it's understandable why they did it. They're not crazy. That was a sensible thing for a profit-maximizing firm to do, to figure out what's the cost-benefit analysis? And you can only do that if you can figure out what the costs are. And the costs in wrongful death suits are the costs of getting convicted for wrongful death. Well, they calculated it out, and it wasn't worth making the repairs. It just doesn't seem right. It's corrosive of particular values. Finally, exit and voice. Exit and voice are a way of describing two ways you deal with a problem. So, prototypical example. You go to a restaurant, you don't like the food, what's your solution to that problem? You don't go back. You exit. You deal with a dissatisfaction with a product or a service by simply not using it again. You exercise your consumer sovereignty by making a choice. Voice is illustrated by you have a problem in a relationship. How do you deal with it? You talk about it. You try to work out the problem. You deliberate. You have dialogue. You express yourself and try to solve the problem. Voice and exit are two ways of dealing with a dissatisfaction in life. Markets encourage the skill of exit. We're expert shoppers. That's what shopping is. To be a really good shopper means you really know how to make choices and how to change your mind when you discover that the choice was a bad one. When you're dissatisfied, you make a different choice. School vouchers as an idea are a way of dealing with the problems of schooling by enabling people to switch schools, to exit schools. Trying to democratize schools and creating stronger school-based community councils where parents and teachers and education-minded community members can sit down and work through the problems of schools and try to improve them, that's voice. That's trying to empower people to solve the problems and change the institutions rather than to simply exit. Markets train us in exit. It's why we use the expression for family formation. We call it a marriage market. Well, if finding the person you fall in love with and commit yourself to form a family, is a market and you're unhappy in the relationship, what's the solution? Find a new spouse. Shop for another one. I mean, the shopping model for dealing with problems as a general way in our society because of the centrality of competitive markets in our lives, the shopping model as a way of solving problems spills over to a shopping model for dealing with personal relations. The alternative is you encounter problems in a relation. Relations are really hard work. I've been married now for 47 years, and it's hard work sometimes. There are rough patches. You have to work things out. Well, you need to be trained. Voice takes skills. Talking to people, listening to people, coming to a compassionate understanding of other people's blind spots rather than just being pissed off about other people's rigidities. Really understanding and figuring out how to do that takes a lot of training, a lot of skills, a lot of practice. Markets train us in exit, how to be good shoppers, not how to be good problem solvers. Well, that's the central content of this contrast between exit and voice. And it's another way in which the free market generates problems in the society rather than provides solutions. Well, I think that clock is, and now that clock seems to have caught up. So somehow, magically, in the last hour and a half, that 6-minute deficit got sneakily caught up. So we actually have 4. I rushed through the end of the exit versus voice because I thought, oh my gosh, I'm running behind. But I think we've ended 2 minutes early today. See you on Thursday.